The recordings that you'll hear shortly are old ones, made in 1950, but they keep history alive for us. It's very easy to take strides backwards in time, and we can use a great span of years in a man to bridge the gap between ourselves and men whose deeds have long since become printed words or enactments, or even legend. Men like Charles Stuart Parnell. We can go back to the living Parnell in one step when we hear these voices. As boys and as adult observers and fellow workers, these men knew him, and they retain an echo of his voice and a memory of his appearance in their hearts. One of these speakers was particularly close to him. He was his friend, his secretary, and the champion of his name, Captain Henry Harrison. On an anniversary of Parnell's death, he said this.
It is 59 years ago today since Parnell died. His death was sheer tragedy for Ireland and for Ireland's cause, as well as for his friends and followers who were left grief-stricken and dismayed. I personally was one of them, proud to call him friend and eager to follow where he led. And I remain today as deeply impressed as ever I was with the personal force of his character and the unfailing insight which illumined his intellect and judgment. In all the years of the past, I have met no one. I have known of no one of comparable qualities in the public life of these islands. No man was ever lied about as Parnell was lied about. No lie was too gross, no calumny too mean to be told about him, to be repeated, even to be recorded about him. I have spent some years in exposing some of the worst lies. I hope in the time left to me to expose some more. And though I name no names, the worst of the lies did not all come from the English. His mother was moved to protest publicly a few days after his death. She said, "They say that Charles was selfish, but that is not true. He was more than generous, and those who are trying to traduce his memory of vultures who owe everything to him." She stressed his generosity to herself and to his brothers and to his sister, Mrs. Dickinson, and she went on. "He had a great deal of chivalry in his character, and a great pity for women was one of his marked traits. That he had been generous to some of his colleagues was well known in the party, as was also the fact that his money bought him no gratitude. In personal relationships, his simplicity and kindliness of manner, his unselfishness and lack of self-assertiveness, his humour and sociability earned him affectionate friendships that did not fade. Those who visited him at Ochabana for shooting and fishing parties knew and told of this gracious side of the political gladiator whose exploits drew down on him the fear, the malice and the vindictiveness of the oppressors of Ireland. If any that hear me wish for confirmation of this aspect of Parnell, let them read what Justin McCarthy and William O'Brien, both his opponents at the last, let them read what they have left recorded in their published works. They each were qualified both by long personal knowledge of Parnell and by their literary skill to observe and to describe him. They both stand much higher on the ladder of biographical writing than the later scavengers who have rummaged in the muck heap of scandal and journalistic offal and who knew him not.
Around the formidable figure were meetings and demonstrations. Wherever he went in Ireland, bonfires were lit and the bands came out. In Rathdrum, County Wicklow, a small boy, William Comerford, was mascot of the band and trotted before it. He remembered the day, and he remembered being spoken to by Parnell.
My first recollection of Mr. Parnell was a very large meeting in the town of Wicklow. There were several bands, including Rathdrum Band, christened by Mr. Parnell himself at Avondale. I was only a very small boy, about 9 or 10, and put in front of the band with a large picture, with banner and a large picture of Mr. Parnell, the chief himself. The following day, after the meeting, I was playing with other boys at the Flannan Hall, the famous Flannan Hall, where Mr. Parnell and I think a Mr. Corbett were driving on an outside car on his way to Ochabanahy Shooting Lodge. He recognised me and got off the car and shook my hand very warmly. I need not tell you how proud I was and will always remember the great honour of shaking hands with the young Crown King of Ireland. I saw him the last time he visited his home at Avondale. He was driving with his sister, Mrs. Dickinson. It was on a Sunday, about 2 o'clock. He was on his way to Greystones to get train for Dublin. As there was no train, bus or motor service those times, he was on his way to his last meeting in Craigs, County Galway. We all cheered him, and he was delighted, acknowledging our cheers with both his hands to his hat. He had a very large rug round his shoulders and looked deadly pale. He did not live long afterwards, God rest his soul.
At a meeting in Mallow in those days, one of the people present was Con McSweeney. Later on, he served in the Connacht Rangers with the rank of major, and eventually he retired to Ochram, not far from the Ochavanna he mentions.
I was at a Landleague meeting in Mallow in the early 1880s. Parnell spoke there. He told the people how to meet the menace of the Landgraver, who was very active in mid-Cork at this time. The boycott was to be strictly enforced. I don't think he used the word boycott. But he was careful to say that the League had no connection with moonlighting. He spoke as one of the authority and was listened to respectfully, but with no great enthusiasm. The boycott was enforced. Captain Moonlight carried on with his activities, and gabbing ceased in mid-Cork. There was also very much less evictions. Many years after, I ran up against, not Parnell, but crowded memories of him in the barracks at Ochavanna. Parnell used to come to Ochavanna every August for the grouse shooting. He invariably had the two Redmonds, John and Willie, with him. Said he used to bring the Redmonds with him so often because they were gentlemen and dead shots both. He couldn't bear the sight of a wounded bird. Parnell had a superstitious horror of the green. He thought it brought ill luck. So the Irish flag was never flown over Ochavan in his time, but Redmond, a Wexford man with crowded memories of the 98 men and their pikes and the flag they fought under so well, flung its folds to the breeze on all possible occasions.
John P. Hayden was proprietor and editor of the Westmeath Examiner. He was also a Member of Parliament. He sat at Westminster during part of three reigns, Queen Victoria's, King Edward VII's, and King George V's. He saw five Prime Ministers, Arthur Balfour, Campbell Bannerman, Asquith, and Lloyd George. And his memory of those days was as clear and precise as his speech at the age of 87.
Well, the first time I saw him was in, as well as I remember, 78, at a meeting in Roscommon. After that, at that period, I was at meetings of his in the County Roscommon and in the County Longford in 78, 79, 80 and 81. Well, I was still in my teens. He made a wonderful impression on me as a clear speaker with a voice far-reaching, his words clear-cut, no unnecessary verbiage. And it must be remembered that he spoke under circumstances that the present generation can have little knowledge of. And without some knowledge of that period, it's difficult to understand the difficulties he had to surmount and the greatness of his achievements in his short leadership. At that time, in the 70s, every position of power and authority in the country was held by people averse to the national aspirations of the people, from the highest to the lowest. The land system was a unique and was described by impartial Englishmen as the worst in the world. The farmers were at the absolute mercy of the landlords or their agents, could be evicted on short notice without any cause except the will of the landlord. All that was changed in a very short time by the agitation conducted by Parnell, by the Act of 1881, which created dual ownership that led eventually and logically to occupying ownership.
When the divorce proceedings began, Parnell was, in the public eye, at the height of his career. Even Scotland had succumbed to him and honoured him at a public dinner in Edinburgh. He was chairman of the Irish Parliamentary Party, having succeeded Butt as leader. Butt, who believed in the niceties and traditions of debate and disapproved of the obstructionist tactics of the nationalist politicians. He was president of the Land League, founded by Michael Davitt. At home, his words rang through the country. Keep a firm grip on your homesteads. The historian Justin McCarthy called him the most remarkable politician who had risen on the field of Irish politics since the day John Mitchell was conveyed away to Bermuda. He was truly the uncrowned king of Ireland. But in 1890 came the result of the divorce proceedings, and we moved to Committee Room 15 in the House of Commons, where Parnell called the party together. John Hayden, to whom we've been listening, knew that he would continue as a supporter of Parnell to the end of his days. But he hadn't yet entered Parliament. His brother Luke was the member, and John P. Hayden, though firm in his own mind, wasn't sure what his brother at Westminster was going to do.
My brother was member for Leitrim at the time of the split. And not knowing what was going to take place, he attended a meeting, the annual meeting of the party, in London. On his way, he told me that he would write to me telling me how things were going. I didn't hear from him or that week, because the he explained to me that the party had come to an understanding that they would not communicate with friends in Ireland, nor in any way would they try to influence opinion. I had to write a leader for my own paper here in Mullingar and for his paper in Roscommon. And without knowing what he was doing, I wrote an article for his papers in strong support of Parnell. Well, I was very glad, I needn't say, when it turned out that I was on the right side for him.
Yes.
I knew, of course, I felt I was on the right side for myself, of course.
Yes.
Because no matter what anyone else had done, I would have supported Parnell.
But the united and unqualified support of Parnell by the Irish Parliamentary Party didn't last long. The split came, and Mr. Gladstone had more than a little to do with it. The Liberals had come into office mainly on the strength of their Home Rule campaign, and being in power, they intended to remain there, whether it suited Ireland or not. John Morley had told Gladstone that if he supported Parnell, he would lose the big nonconformist vote. It was evident that he'd lose many other supporters as well, and so Gladstone addressed a letter to the Irish Party demanding Parnell's resignation. This letter brought about the split, because many of the party agreed that the support of Gladstone and the Liberals was essential to Home Rule. But Parnell saw himself as something more than a member of Parliament representing a piece of territory. He was, till that moment, the leader of the Irish people, and he refused, as chairman, to put a resolution concerning his own resignation. 45 of the members of the Irish Party went to another room and declared that he was no longer the leader. 26 remained loyal to him. Parnell now decided to form a nationalist party completely free from English party ties, and he turned to a group with which he'd never had much to do. Davitt, who had abandoned him, called them the Hillside Men. They were the Fenians.
Parnell, in my opinion, was a man that believed in the right of Ireland to free herself by any lawful means. He was not a man in favour of force other than legitimate warfare. He was strongly against outrages of any sort. That was shown after the Phoenix Park murders, when he publicly tendered his resignation as leader. That had such a dreadful effect upon him that he was quite prepared to retire from public life.
The new campaign was the start of Parnell's retirement, not only from public life, but from life itself.
Last time that I met Parnell was in the train at the railway station of Mullingar. Through this town he had to pass on his way to all his meetings in the West. A number of his supporters always met him at the station, and it was customary for him to make a brief speech to us whilst the train was in the station. On this occasion, he was accompanied by Dr. Joe Quinn, who was an official of the National League. And when the train arrived, Dr. Quinn put his head out through the window and asked for me and told me Mr. Parnell was not well enough to make a speech, but that he would like to speak to me. And I sat in the carriage with him for about 5 minutes whilst the train delayed, and he went off then to Roscommon for his last public meeting, which took place in Craigs in the County Galway.
And so the story moves to Craigs. That man has death in his eyes, someone had said in Mullingar Station. And this was Parnell's last and bitterest fight. He'd seen his party split in two, and now, wherever he went, he demanded a purely nationalist party, unallied to any English political party. Michael Murray of Knockmuskell, near Craigs, heard him speak that day.
Well, he said that he did his best for the tenant farmers of Ireland, and that he also put a stop to the tyranny of landlordism. Mm-hmm. He also said that today the tenant farmers of Ireland, that their homes are their castle. Well, years previous to that, they couldn't say that. After they paid their rent, the landlord could come with his battered and ram and evict them.
Yes.
He said that he hoped to be able to do more for the Irish people, but that today, unfortunately, his health was poor.
Yes.
And that today some of his own dogs were barking at him. Hmm. He didn't mention any name.
Did you understand him to mean anything?
I understood that it was some of his own colleagues in the House of Commons.
Yes.
Some of the Irish party.
Perhaps you heard an infant cry behind that voice. That was John, a grandson who must be going on for 13 years old now, and who can tell people that he was carried in the arms of men who heard Parnell speak. That's how we step back in time. And now we return to County Wicklow, and John Kelly of Ballyse, he played for Parnell's cricket team. He remembered volunteers coming to Avondale to save the harvest when the leader was in Kilmainham, and at a very great age, he talked about the Land League.
The people were mixed here.
All round here?
Round here. There was Mooney's in New Barn, and Barry against the Slave Row, and Burns of Broad Street, and where they said, here around, huh? And Tim Mullen. The man that took these farms was a publican in Rathdrum.
Yes.
His name was Saul. Sam Saul, you know that, Saul, but that.
Well, the league became very strong here. The league was very strong.
We never was a doubt of a division of the national organisation in Rathdrum. We never was a doubt of a branch of the National League, the United Irish League, and the commenced first with the Land League. And the Land League was proclaimed here, and there was a ladies' Land League formed. And Mrs. Cowley and Mrs. O'Neill and Mrs. Mulhern and Miss Byrne and a whole lot of those was in it.
Well, now, the last you saw of Parnell was at Kingstown.
At Kingstown, yes. The last I saw was at Kingstown. Show that little book there.
His last journey?
That was his last journey. He said he'd come back on Saturday.
But he never did.
He came back dead.
He came back dead. And on the very day that he'd given for his return. One of the great political legal figures of a later age, Sergeant Sullivan, was then doing part-time newspaper work. The news was slow to come to Ireland and slow to be believed.
As assistant editor of the Evening Press, I was writing my London letter when the door opened and my stone man, Lane, entered. He handed me a crumpled slip of paper and said, "I believe that that's true." On the paper in a boyish hand was written, "Parnell is dead." I had a conviction myself that it was true, and I at once had the news set and saddled on the machine and had the placards printed, and then I paused. I was assistant editor of a fiercely anti-Parnellite paper and could take no risk. Accordingly, I put on my hat and I went to my old Parnellite friends, Tim Harrington, Dr. Joe Kenny, Val Dillon, put my head in the National Club, and found that there was no sign of news affecting Parnell current in Dublin at the time.
Accordingly, I got on to our London correspondent and ordered him to personally interview Parnell. I had to wait there with the greatest journalistic scoop of the day settled on my machines, and it was an hour and a half before I received a telegram from Brighton. Parnell died here last night. And in a few minutes, my machines were roaring it to the world.
The anonymous message had come from a telegraph boy who delivered a message to Parnell's sister and heard someone exclaim, "Parnell is dead." The boy was a friend of Lane, the stone man mentioned by Sergeant Sullivan, and he passed on the news. Lane could be alive still. But most of the voices you've heard have gone from us, and we've no record at all of the voice of Parnell. But as long as anyone holds an acre of land to himself and for himself, the memory of Parnell will endure. And it was to symbolise this that they placed above his grave in Glasnevin a single rock of granite from his own county of Wicklow, a rock not cut into conformity with his surroundings, as he himself never conformed, a rock bearing upon it the single word of power that once could have united Ireland.
One last word. Parnell was the least self-conscious of men. His simple sincerity of thought and action left no room for posing. I myself heard him in Committee Room 15 when the tormenting obscurities left by a part-told tale clamoured for explanation. For me, his words brought full reassurance. He told us, "I would rather appear to be dishonourable than be dishonourable."
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.